Schuster Audio presents Tom Clancy's Off Center, Mission of Honor. Created by Tom Clancy and Steve Puchenik and written by Jeff Robin. Read by Armin Schultz.
Maun, Botswana, Monday, 4:53 a.m. The sun rose swiftly over the flat, seemingly endless plain. The landmarks had changed in the decade since Prince Leon Soronga had first come here. Behind them, the Kwai River was not as deep as it had been. The grasses of the plain were shorter but more plentiful, covering familiar boulders and ravines. But the former army officer had no trouble recognizing the place or reconnecting with the transformations that had started here. Walking into the new dawn, the 6'3" Soronga watched as the deep black sky seemed to catch fire. It started at a point and spilled all along the horizon like liquid flame. Stars that had been so bright just moments before quickly dimmed and faded like the last of fireworks. Within seconds, the sharp crescent moon dimmed from the sickle-edged brilliance to cloud-like. All around him, the sleeping earth became active. The wind began to move. High-flying hawks and tiny kinglets took flight. Fleas started to creep along Leon's army boots. Field mice dashed through the grasses to the north. That is power, thought the lean, dreadlocked man. The retired Democratic Army soldier wondered if Damballa felt a hint of that same prepotency when he woke each morning. It was still too early in his ministry, yet if a leader is a leader born, he must feel something of that flame, that heat, that strength. While nature unfolded as it always did with both grandeur and detail, there was also something special about this morning. It was more than what Leon was about to do, though that was extraordinary enough. There were 52 men marching behind the former Botswana Army colonel in two tight columns. He had trained them himself in secret, and he was confident of their abilities. But for a brief time, the sights and sensations took the 56-year-old Botswana native back to when he had first witnessed dawn on the majestic floodplain. It was on a savagely muggy August morning in 1958. Leon was 11 years old, the age of passage for men of the small Batawana tribe. He clearly remembered walking between his father and his uncle, both of whom were big and powerful. In Leon's mind, they were what a man was supposed to be, tall and upright. He did not yet understand the concepts of confidence and pride, loyalty and love, bravery and patriotism. Those qualities came later, the qualities that made the inner man. Back then, he found that he had the will and ability to slaughter animals for food, but he did not yet understand that it was a man's prerogative, and often his responsibility, to kill other men for honor or country. The men were not armed with anything like the fusil automatique assault rifle Leon Soronga carried now. They were armed with 9-inch knives tucked in giraffeskin sheaths, iron-tipped spears, and a coil of rope carried around the left shoulder. Bare-chested, dressed only in sandals and loincloths, the men made their way unhurriedly along the eastern edge of the flat Kwai River floodplain. On that great and majestic morning, the hunters from Moremi were after giant forest hogs. The brown and black bristled herbivores inhabited the intermediate zones between forest and grassland. A family of the animals had been spotted the day before by one of the men. The pigs moved in small groups and tended to become active not long after dawn, before predators were up and about. Leon's father, Maurice, had told him that it was important to catch the hogs when they were just beginning to forage. They knew the lions were not awake yet. That was when their attention was primarily on food and not on potential predators. The men were successful that morning. They killed a fat old hog that had wandered from the group. Or maybe the group had wandered from the hog. Perhaps they had left it out there as sacrificial prey. The knee-high pig was speared by Leon's uncle, who had crept close from behind and then launched himself at the beast. Leon could see that initial jet of blood from behind the pig's shoulder. It was the most exciting thing he had ever experienced. Leon's father had rushed forward, the The dying animal was flipped onto its side before the other hogs were even aware that anything had happened. The other beasts did not scatter until Maurice had already knelt on the beast's shoulder, pinning it and slashed its throat. The animal was quickly noosed with one of the ropes. That would prevent it from bleeding and attracting carrion feeders like silver-backed jackals. The blood would also keep the meat moist as they transported the heavy carcass under the searing sun. While Maurice and his brother stanched the bleeding, the young boy and the other men found two long branches. These were quickly stripped with knives and used as carrying poles. Before the pig was trussed, Maurice paused to slip a bloody finger between his son's lips. Then he bent very close to his son. He wanted the boy to see the conviction in his eyes.
"Remember this moment, my son," the elder man said softly. "Remember this taste. Our people cannot survive without shedding blood. We cannot exist without risk."
The hog was a good-sized animal that fed the village for 2 days. After the meat was finished, its bones already carved into trinkets for sale to occasional tourists, another group of men went out to hunt. Leon was sorry not to be going with them. He was already thinking of tackling a zebra or gazelle or maybe even a lion. Leon even told his mother of his dream to kill a great cat. That was when he got his nickname. Bertrice Soronga told her son that only a prince could get close enough to kill a king.
"Are you a prince?" she asked.
Leon said that maybe he was. The woman smiled and began calling him Prince Leon. In 1963, the world changed. Leon's thoughts turned from the habits of animals to the habits of men. In 1962, men from the capital city of Gaborone and from London had arrived in the small village by airplane. At the time, Botswana had been known as Bechuana Land. It was a British protectorate and had been so since 1885. It was being protected, Leon had been taught, from South African Boers and other aggressors. The white men from Gaborone and London told the Botswanans that the animals were being hunted out of existence. The men said that the tribe's people had to change the way they lived, or eventually they would perish. With the blessings of the elders of all the local tribes, the government transformed the entire floodplain and vast surrounding areas into the Maremi Wildlife Reserve. Tourism, rather than hunting, would become the mainstay of the people of the region. A good deal of money was paid to every family. Construction teams arrived by truck and airplane 3 weeks later. They razed the old village and built houses of wood and tin. Farther out, where there were no signs of civilization, they also built the Kwai River Lodge. They made that of stone and tile. Each week, the trucks that brought food to the lodge also brought food that the villagers could buy. Schools were established. Missions that had been responsible for education and medical care took a more active role in the running of the local villages. The old gods, gods of the hunt and of thunder, were displaced and forgotten. Radios, and then television, replaced storytelling. European-style clothes and jewelry and housing were coveted. The animals of the floodplain were saved. So, too, the Potawatomis were told, were their lives and their immortal souls. Leon had never been convinced of that. What his people had gained in security, they had lost in independence. They had been given knowledge at the expense of wisdom. Faith had taken the place of religion. They had secured life and surrendered living. When he was 18, Leon left the village. He had read about a man in Gaborone, Sir Seretse Khama, whose Democratic Party was working to free his nation from British control. Leon enlisted in Khama's Democratic Army. It was a peaceful group of nearly 3,000 men. Their job was to hand out leaflets and ensure the security of their leader. Leon did not enjoy that work. He was a hunter. Together with 5 men who felt the same way he did, Leon formed the Brush Vipers. They worked in secret to collect intelligence on key British officials. Among their discoveries was a plot to frame Sir Khama for embezzling funds from his Democratic Party. Within days, the chief plotter vanished. Sir Khama never learned of the plan against him or of the counterstrike, but the English knew. Leon had made very certain of that. Despite the quiet demands of the Foreign Office, the Englishman was never located. Few outsiders who went into the Okavango swamp alive were ever seen again. Leon did, however, give the chief foreign officer the man's watch. The Badawanan told him he had no desire to start a collection of British timepieces. The CFO got the message. A year later, the British ceded control of the country. Bechuanaland became the Republic of Botswana, with Khama as its first president. Leon was given a commission as second lieutenant and joined the Botswana Defense Forces. He helped to organize security along the border with war-ravaged Angola. He also instructed native Angolans on intelligence-gathering techniques to use against the Portuguese. Like his brothers in Botswana and South Africa, he wanted to see the Europeans driven from Africa. Despite the efforts of Leon and the president, the nation continued to change. Leon watched as his people became fat and eviscerated. Like the hog Soronga and his father had hunted so long ago, the Botswanans were prey for hunters, men from Europe who came back with money. Botswanans sold the hard-won coal mines, the copper mines, the diamond mines. They had thrown off political control only to surrender to economic control. The revolution had been for nothing. During this time, his greatest comfort was his own family. Lieutenant Soronga married when he returned to the north. He and his wife had four sons. In time, they began bearing him grandchildren. It was for their sake, finally, that he left the defense forces. He retired on a pension for a time. But then, something happened. He found a new cause, a new army to lead. Leon and his men rounded a clump of high grasses and came upon a familiar pond. The watering hole was smaller than it used to be. Irrigation had changed the floodplains and the pigs had been relocated. Only the field mice and a few flightless birds came here to drink. But it was still, unmistakably, the pond where he had begun his road to manhood. Distant structures appeared on the horizon beyond the waving grasses. There were six of them built of logs with ceramic tile roofs. The sun glinted on the white satellite dish in a clearing. It played on the chrome of the cars and vans parked in the dirt lot. Leon motioned for his men to stay low behind the grass. He knew that they should have come here in the dark, but it was important that he see the sunrise. Besides, the tourists inside the compound would not be up yet. Scouts had reported that the shutters remained closed until nearly 8 a.m. The foreigners liked their sleep. Saving the nation would not be easy, and it would not be bloodless, but that was to be expected. Revolutions seldom were. Maun, Botswana, Monday, 5:19 a.m. Father Pois Bradbury opened his eyes a moment before the sun peeked over the windowsill. He smiled as he watched the white walls and ceiling brighten. The South African native usually rose at first light. Throughout his 43 years as a priest, Bradbury had made it a habit of saying his morning offering at the break of day. The prayer was about dedicating one's day to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. It seemed only right to do that when the day began, not when it was convenient. The short, wispy man continued to smile as he lay in his small twin bed. The only other pieces of furniture were a night table, a wardrobe at the foot of the bed, and a desk across the room. There was a simple laptop computer on the desk. Father Bradbury used that primarily for email. The computer was surrounded by stacks of books and periodicals, which were also piled on the floor of the small room. The priest subscribed to newspapers from across the continent. He enjoyed finding out what other Africans were thinking. The clergyman had been in Botswana for 11 years. He had spent 7 of those years as a deacon missionary. He still had the rough feet and sunburned face to prove it. He had spent the last 4 years as a parish priest at the 47-year-old Church of the Holy Cross, which ministered to the neighboring villages of Maun and Moremi. Bradbury missed the church terribly whenever he was away. He missed the individual congregants. The priest loved being a daily part of their lives, their thoughts, their faith. Whenever Father Bradbury was gone, he also missed the tourists. For purely proselytical reasons, Archbishop Patrick had supported the construction of the tourist center adjoining the church. Many of the visitors were young. Religion did not play a large part in their lives. Archbishop Patrick thought that an inspirational place like the reserve might bring them nearer the Creator. For Father Bradbury, the tourists also brought something. something more secular, but no less important. Their wide-eyed awe at the countryside reaffirmed his own sense of wonder and pride in the region. The priest threw off the lightweight top sheet. Even this far from the river, Father Bradbury needed a mosquito net. He was grateful for it. The priest had what his mother used to call candy sweet veins. Mosquitoes loved him. In addition to sore feet, he did not miss the mosquitoes, gnats, and parasitic warble flies that were part of his years of carrying the word of God from village to village. After showering in the tiny washroom, Father Bradbury dressed. Then he stepped outside into the warm morning. The sky was shading from deep blue to cerulean. There were no clouds, just the fair, faint crescent moon high on the northern horizon. It was a good morning and a good life. A few seconds later, both the morning and Father Bradbury's life were changed. There were a series of loud pops from inside the compound. Then he heard shouting. The priest ran around the church. His sandals clopped on the stones of the walk. At the front of the church was a rose garden that he had planted himself. He had put them there so they would have the early morning sun. The church protected them from the late morning on. Father Bradbury reached the courtyard that fronted the tourist center. The 63-year-old director of the center was already standing outside. Suana Ndebele was still dressed in his underwear. He was also wearing a look of tempered rage. His bare arms were raised ear high. About 10 feet behind him, one of the tour guides and several tourists were grouped together just outside the door of the main office. They were all facing the open gate. Their hands were also lifted. None of them moved. The priest noticed several bullet holes in the oak door frame. He turned toward the gate. The gate was made of iron bars that resembled Badawana spears. The door had been swung inside, and over 4 dozen men were assuming positions along the inside wall of the courtyard. They were dressed in camouflage uniforms with black berets. Each man carried a firearm. They did not wear insignias or chevrons of rank. They were not government soldiers. "No," Father Bradbury muttered, "not here." There had been no rebels in this land since the 1960s. There was no need. The government was democratically elected, and people were generally content. The soldiers were approximately 200 feet away. The priest walked toward them.
"Father, don't,"
Ndebele warned. The priest ignored him. This was an outrage. The nation was run by a lawfully elected government, and this reserve was holy ground, not just the home of a church, but a place of peace. The militiamen finished filing into the courtyard. One of the men walked forward. He was a tall, lean man with long dreadlocks and a resolute expression. He was obviously the leader of the unit. Not because of what he carried, but because of how he carried himself. His dark eyes glistened even brighter than the sunlit sweat that covered his forehead and cheeks.
"I am Father Poes Bradbury," the priest said. His voice was soft but firm.
The two men continued to approach one another.
"Why have armed men come to our compound?"
"To take you with us," the leader replied.
"Me?"
Bradbury demanded.
The priest stopped just a few feet from the taller man.
"Why? What have I done?"
"You are an invader," the man told him.
"You and your kind will be driven out."
3 of the soldiers jogged forward. 2 of them seized Father Bradbury by his forearms. Suana Ndebele made a move as if to protest. The motion was met by the distinctive click of a rifle bolt. Ndebele stopped. The 3rd militiaman went behind the priest. He pulled a black hood over Father Bradbury's head. He tied it tightly around the clergyman's throat. Father Bradbury gagged. Hands pushed roughly against Father Bradbury's shoulder blades. He stumbled forward. Only the men holding his arms kept him from falling. They tugged him up and ahead. The priest went with them. Father Bradbury said nothing. It was all he could do to breathe. The heat was terrible and the darkness was unnerving. He also did not want to show fear to these men. But Father Poes Bradbury could not hide his fear from God. And it was to God whom he spoke silently as the militiamen led him from the compound. Washington, D.C., Tuesday, 7:54 a.m. It was a dark, rainy morning, and DiMaggio's Joe was not as jammed as usual. That was fine with General Mike Rogers. He had been able to find a parking spot directly outside the coffee bar,
and he had spotted a small, clean corner table inside. He walked to the back of the room, slapped his damp cap and his copy of the Washington Post on the empty table, then got in line. The line at the counter moved quickly, and to Roger's amazement, the display case actually had what he wanted. He paid for his oversized corn muffin and an ultra-tall cup of coffee. Then he returned to the table and sat on the stool facing the back wall. The legendary DiMaggio's Joe was located in Georgetown, on the corner of M Street and Wisconsin Avenue. The coffee shop had been established in 1966 by a transplanted New Yorker named Bronx Taylor. Taylor was a New York Yankees fan back when the Washington Senators were their rivals, and people could still smoke in coffee shops. Fans of the baseball Senators used to come in to yell at Taylor. They were all blue-collar workers back then. The men would come in and deride the Yankees over juice, sausage, and watery eggs, and pie, and coffee, and a smoke or two, and more coffee. Taylor made a fortune at this little place. When Bronx died 4 years ago, his daughter Alexandra took over. The diner was gentrified. Instead of a counter and booths with large, solid formica tables, there were now wood stools with stands that had wobbly metal lattice tops. And Alexandra no longer served just one kind of coffee. There were flavors and fragrances and blends. Rogers still ordered plain and black coffee, even though it tasted as if it were brewed with potpourri. Apart from the name of the place, Alexandra had left one thing more or less intact. Taylor had covered all four walls with framed photographs and faded newspaper front pages. The pictures were of Yankee Stadium and the star players of the 1940s and 1950s. Alexandra had collected them all on the back wall, and they were the only reason Rogers still came. Rogers grew up in Hartford, Connecticut, which was closer to Boston than New York, but he was still a Yankees fan. They were also largely responsible for his becoming a soldier. Mike Rogers could not hit a baseball worth a damn, as his lifelong friend and former Little League teammate Colonel Brett August often reminded him. Rogers had the eye, but he did not have the power in his arms. Rogers could sure shoot, though. Thanks to the Yankees, Rogers associated the idea of wearing a uniform with belonging to an elite team. Since the Yankees did not need a sharpshooter, Rogers turned his sights on that other great team with uniforms, the United States military. The 47-year-old general never regretted a day of the life he had chosen, until 4 months ago. Stryker was the elite rapid response military arm of the National Crisis Management Center. Rogers was the deputy director of the NCMC, familiarly known as Op Center. Upon joining Op Center shortly after its inception, Rogers had formed and trained the unit. A little over 4 months ago, while parachuting into the Himalayan mountains, General Rogers and Colonel August had watched as all but one other member of Stryker was shot from the sky. In Vietnam, Rogers had lost close friends and fellow soldiers, but Rogers had never experienced anything like this. Op Center's staff psychologist, Liz Gordon, told Rogers that he was suffering from post-traumatic syndrome. The condition manifested itself as lethargy and depression, resulting from escaping death that took others. Clinically, that might be true. What Rogers really suffered from was a crisis of faith. But Liz Gordon had told him one thing that was certainly true. If Rogers continued to dwell on what had gone wrong, he would be no good to Op Center or its director, Paul Hood. And both needed him now. Stryker had to be rebuilt, and Hood had to deal with ongoing budget cuts. Mike Rogers turned from the back wall. He sat down, unfolded the newspaper, and scanned the front page. The headline that caught his attention was about an apparent paramilitary action in Botswana. The nation rarely showed up on the morning intelligence reports. The government in Gaborone was stable, and the people were relatively content. Even when he was down on his abilities, Mike Rogers could not help but ruminate about military issues. The army was not just his profession, but his avocation. He read the rest of the front page while he finished his coffee, then he refolded the newspaper and slid it protectively under his arm. Rogers made his way through the pinball array of tables to the front door. He pulled on his hat and stepped onto the slick pavement. The rain was heavy, but Rogers did not mind. The gray tones of the morning suited his mood, and though the dampness did not feel comfortable, he was surprised to find that it made him feel good. The pictures reminded him of what he had dreamed,
Each droplet reminded him of what he had, something that his former teammates did not possess. Life. Washington, D.C., Tuesday, 8:33 a.m. The National Crisis Management Center was housed in a two-story building at Andrews Air Force Base. During the Cold War, this nondescript ivory-colored structure was one of two staging areas for flight crews known as Nuclear Rapid Response Divisions. With the fall of the Soviet Union and the downsizing of the Air Force's Rapid Response Divisions, evacuation operations were consolidated at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. The newly vacated building at Andrews was given over to the newly chartered National Crisis Management Center. The two floors of upstairs offices were for non-classified operations such as finance, human resources, and monitoring the mainstream press for possible hot buttons. The basement of the former Rapid Response Division's building had been entirely refurbished. It no longer housed living quarters for flight crews. It was where the tactical decisions and intelligence crunching of Op Center took place. The executive level was accessible by a single elevator that was guarded 24/7. Paul Hood, Mike Rogers, Bob Herbert, and the rest of the executives had their offices down here. The small offices were arranged in a ring along the outer wall of the basement. Inside the circle were cubicles that housed the executive assistants as well as Op Center's intelligence gathering and processing personnel. On the opposite side of the room from the elevator was a conference room known as the tank. The conference room was surrounded by walls of electronic waves that generated static to anyone trying to listen in with bugs or external dishes. Bob Herbert pushed his wheelchair down the oval corridor. His coat was damp and his ears were cold, but he was glad to be here. There were no windows down here, and the rooms were not spacious, but Herbert never believed all that crap about people needing sunshine to brighten their mood. The 39-year-old intelligence chief only needed two things to make him happy. One was his motorized wheelchair. The balding intelligence expert had lost the use of his legs in the Beirut embassy bombing in 1983. The wheelchair did not just keep Herbert mobile. It had a fold-away arm, like an airplane seat, that housed his computer with a wireless modem. Everything Herbert needed, including email, addresses to order pizza, were literally in his lap. Op Center's technical expert, Matt Stoll, had even installed a jack for a satellite dish. At times, Herbert felt like the bionic man. The other thing that made Herbert happy was when outsiders left him and his co-workers alone to do their jobs. When Op Center first began operations, no one paid them much attention, whether they were saving the space shuttle from saboteurs or Japan from nuclear annihilation. Everything they did was covert. Unfortunately, the dynamics changed drastically after Paul Hood personally resolved a highly public hostage standoff at the United Nations. Foreign governments complained to the White House about Hood's unsanctioned military activity on international territory. The Central Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, and even the State Department complained to the Congressional Intelligence Oversight Committee, the CIOC. They accused Paul Hood of usurping personnel and chartered responsibilities from both agencies. The Pentagon said that Op Center had monopolized the spy satellite capabilities of the National Reconnaissance Office. All of that was true, but the truth did not always tell the whole story. None of these activities were done for the aggrandizement of Paul Hood or the NCMC. Because of politics, not effectiveness or cost efficiency, the CIOC had ordered Paul Hood to cut his operating budget. This morning, Hood was supposed to learn the results of the quarterly follow-up conducted by the CIOC Finance Subcommittee. Hood, Rogers, and Herbert hoped that tempers had cooled somewhat in 4 months. The previous day, the men had submitted their written petition to get some of the cuts rescinded. Among other things, training a new striker team was going to take additional funds. Herbert passed Paul Hood's office. The door was open. Since Hood's separation from his wife Sharon, he had been getting to the office earlier and earlier. For all Herbert knew, his boss had slept here instead of going back to his new apartment. Not that it mattered. Staying busy had helped keep Hood's spirits from sinking. The intelligence chief certainly understood that. His own wife was killed in the blast that had cost him the use of his legs. After her death, all Herbert wanted to do was work. He needed to keep his mind moving forward, engaged in something constructive. Hood was gazing at his computer monitor. Herbert rapped lightly on the door jamb. Good morning, Herbert said.
Hood glanced toward the door.
He looked tired.
Morning, Bob. Is Mike in yet?
Hood asked.
I haven't seen him, Herbert replied.
What's up?
Hood hesitated.
The usual, he said quietly.
That told Herbert a lot.
Well, let me know if there's anything I can do, Herbert said.
There will be, Hood assured him.
He did not elaborate. Herbert continued down the hallway. He did not bother trying to guess what Hood had to say to Rogers. Herbert was an intelligence man, and right now, he had very little intelligence to go on. But he did know two things. One was that the news was grave. Paul Hood had been mayor of Los Angeles before coming to Op Center. He was a politician. Hood's silence a moment ago was not about keeping secrets. It was about protocol. His tone had told Herbert that the news was bad. The fact that Hood did not want to tell Herbert, his trusted number three man, meant that Mike Rogers was entitled to hear it first. That told Herbert it was personal. Okavango Swamp, Botswana, Tuesday, 4:35 p.m. The Okavango River is the fourth longest river system in southern Africa. The wide river runs southeasterly for over 1,000 miles, from central Angola to northern Botswana. There, it ends in a vast delta known as the Okavango Swamp. The Great Triangular Delta covers an area of some 6,500 miles. Much of the region is under 3 feet of water during the rainy season. For the rest of the year, just over half the swamp is as dry as the surrounding plains. After leaving the Maun Tourist Center, Leon Saranga had led his four-vehicle caravan north through the Maremi Wildlife Reserve, located beyond the northeastern corner of the Okavango Swamp. The unit was riding Mercedes Sprinters that had been given to them by the Belgian. The necessary evil, as Saranga referred to him in private among his men. The vehicles had been flown to the Belgian's private airfield in Lehutu in the Kalahari. Dambala saw to the spirits, but the necessary evil and his people saw to everything else. Leon was sitting in the rearmost seat of the second van. His prisoner lay on his side in the small storage section of the van. The men had tied his hands behind him and bound his feet before laying him inside. He was still wearing the hood and was wheezing audibly. The van was hot. Inside the mask, it was even hotter. Leon had kept the mask on for two reasons. First, to dehydrate the priest and keep him weak. Second, to force him to draw some of his own exhaled carbon dioxide with each breath. That would keep the priest lightheaded. Both would make Father Bradbury more cooperative when they reached their destination. The priest was nestled among stacks of thigh-high wading boots and several cans of petrol. After more than 12 hours driving through the reserve, the group reached the southernmost edge of the Okavango Swamp. Because it was well after dark, the militiamen made camp. The trip would resume at daybreak. When the men awoke shortly before dawn, Leon selected six men to continue the journey with him. It was just after the rainy season, and the dark waters still stretched to the outer boundaries of the swamp. The priest was hefted onto the back of one of the men. He was weak, and Leon did not have time to walk him through the swamp. The militiamen set out, wading through the sloshy waters. They had tied a pair of motorboats to a tree on a small island 400 yards offshore. Upon reaching the two boats, the men were divided. They fired up the engines and sped into the brightening morning. The journey northward lasted nearly 10 hours. Saranga and Dambala had selected a base that was close to the northeastern edge of the swamp. If it became necessary for Dambala to escape, the Barani salt pan and the rugged Sodilo Hills lay to the west. The relatively unguarded border with Namibia was just a short 55-mile trip to the north. By the time the men reached their destination, the sun was low on the horizon. It shone in long, tawny red streaks beyond the rich green of the plants and trees. The swamp itself was already dark, its surface like an oily mirror. A low, symmetrical, treeless hill rose from the water. It was approximately 12 acres of black earth, soil topped with a layer of fertile gray-brown humus. Built on the low-lying hill were five thatched huts. The walls were made of thick slab-cut pieces of baobab tree. The rooftops were interwoven roots sealed with mud. Battery-powered lights were visible through the thatching of the central residence, which was also the largest of the huts. One structure was radically different from the others on the island. It was an oblong shack about the size of two coffins set back to back. Except for the floor, which was made of wood, it was built entirely from corrugated tin. There were iron bars in front and a tin door behind them. The door was open. There was nothing and no one inside. Two armed guards patrolled the island at all times. As Saranga and his team neared the southern shore, the sentries turned bright flashlights on them. Saranga and his men stopped.
Bon Dieu, Saranga said.
Bas, said a voice as one of the flashlights snapped off. Saranga had uttered their password, the name of their guardian deity. One of the guards left to inform Dambala that the team had returned. Washington, D.C., Tuesday, 10:18 a.m. Mike Rogers entered the small, brightly lit reception area. A young female guard stood in a bulletproof glass booth just inside the door. She saluted smartly as Rogers entered.
Good morning, General, the sentry said.
Good morning, Rogers replied. He stopped.
Valentine, he said.
Go right in, sir,
the guard replied. She pressed the button that opened the elevator door. Valentine was Rogers' personal password for the day. It was left on his secure GovNet email pager the night before. Even if the guard had recognized Rogers, he would not have been allowed to enter if his password did not match what was on her computer. Rogers rode the elevator to the basement. As he stepped out, he bumped into Bob Herbert.
Robert?
Rogers said.
Morning, Mike, Herbert said quietly.
I was just coming to see you, Rogers said. He handed Herbert the Washington Post.
Did you see the article about the kidnapping in Botswana?
Yes. They caught that item upstairs, Herbert told him, refolding the newspaper.
What do you make of it? Rogers asked.
Too early to say, Herbert answered truthfully.
The uniforms don't sound like the men were Botswana Army regulars, Rogers went on.
No, Herbert agreed. We haven't had any reports of paramilitary activity in Botswana, but it could be a new group.
There's something about the size of the group and the timing of the attack that bothers me, Rogers said. Why send so many soldiers to kidnap a single unarmed man, and in daylight no less? A small squad could have picked him up in the middle of the night.
That's true, Herbert agreed. Herbert's eyes were on the general. Rogers was restless. His eyes were searching, not steady as they usually were. There was an unhappy turn to his mouth. He looked like a man who had put something down and couldn't remember where.
Herbert flipped over the newspaper and glanced at it. He slid the newspaper into the leather pocket on the side of his wheelchair.
I'll make calls to our embassy, see if this smells dangerous to anyone, find out if there's any additional intel. Meanwhile, Paul was asking if you were in yet.
Roger's expression perked. Did he hear from the CIOC? The general asked.
I don't know, Herbert said.
He would have told you if he had, Roger said.
Not necessarily. He's supposed to brief his number two man first.
There's one way to find out, Rogers said.
The general stepped around the wheelchair.
And thanks for checking out that priest for me.
My pleasure, Herbert replied.
Hood's door was closed when Rogers arrived. The director's assistant, Bugs Benet, was sitting in a cubicle directly across from the door. Bugs told Rogers that Hood was on a personal call.
I don't expect it to be a long conversation, Benet said.
Hood was probably talking to his wife, Sharon. The two had recently reached an agreement on terms for their divorce. From what little Hood had confided to Rogers, their primary goal now was the rehabilitation of their daughter, Harley. The young girl was one of the hostages taken by terrorists at the United Nations. After nearly a half year of intensive therapy, Harley was at last beginning to recover from the trauma she had suffered.
He's off now, General, Bugs said.
The general nodded. He did not have to knock. There was a small security camera in the upper left corner. Hood already knew Rogers was there.
Good morning, Mike. Sit down,
Hood said. The general lowered himself into one of the room's two armchairs. Hood did not waste time getting to the point. Mike, I received an emailed letter of resolution from Senator Fox early this morning, Hood told him. He regarded the general. The CIOC has voted unanimously not to allow the NCMC to rebuild its military capacity. Rogers felt as if someone had driven a baseball bat into his gut. We can't restaff Stryker? Rogers said, still in disbelief. Hood looked down. No. But they can't order that, Rogers protested. They have. No, Rogers said. Stryker is mandated by charter. Fox would need an act of Congress to change it. Even if we sent Stryker on an unauthorized mission, disciplinary actions are to be directed against the commanders in the field and at HQ, and not against the unit individually or in total. They took pains to point out that this is not a disciplinary action, Hood told him. Like hell it isn't, Rogers snapped. Mike, we stepped on the toes of the military and made things rough for the embassy in New Delhi, Hood said. Oh, and I'm bleeding for them, Rogers said. Would they have preferred dealing with a nuclear attack? Mike, what was going on between Pakistan and India was not our official business. We went in to reconnoiter, not intervene. Yes, you have humanitarian rights on your side. They have political ramifications on their side. That's why the CIOC is hitting us so hard. No, they're just hitting us low, Rogers shot back. I informed Senator Fox that the NCMC would comply with the resolution, Hood said. Rogers could not believe this was happening. What had happened to Stryker in the field was crushing enough, but at least they died in action. To be shut down and humiliated by a clutch of soft, self-serving politicians like this was unbearable. He wondered if they were also hoping to get his own resignation. Maybe they would. He did not want to give them the satisfaction, but he also did not have the patience for this kind of bureaucracy anymore. Mike, I know this is a tough blow, Hood went on, but this does not have to be a terminal blow. Hood typed something on the keyboard of his computer. I'm going to throw some names at you. Maria Corneja, Aideen Marley, Fala Shibli, David Batat, Harold Moore, and Zach Bemler, Hood said. What do these people have in common? Well, they're agents we've worked with over the years, Rogers said. There's something else most of them share, Hood said. Except for Aideen, none of them ever served in the military, and none of them is in it now. I'm not following you, Rogers said apologetically. These people are not governed by the CIOC resolution or restrictions. What I'm saying is that we get back in the field, but we don't do it with a military team. We don't replace Stryker. Infiltration, Rogers said. Now he got it. We diffuse situations from the inside rather than the outside. Exactly, Hood replied. Damn. That's good, Rogers said. Thanks. We have an absolute mandate to collect intelligence. The CIOC doesn't control that. So we run this as a black ops unit. Only you, Bob Herbert, and one or two others know about it. Our people fly commercial airlines, work with cover profiles, move around in daylight, in public. They hide in plain sight, Rogers said. Right. We run an old-fashioned humint operation. Rogers nodded. Any thoughts? Hood asked. Not at the moment. Any questions? Just one. I already have the answer to that, Hood said. He smiled. You start right now. Okavango Swamp, Botswana, Tuesday, 5:36 p.m. For a time, his shoulders, arms, and legs were hounded by mosquitoes and other biting insects. The humidity was greater here than on the plain. Breathing was even more difficult than the previous day. Perspiration dripped into his dry mouth, turning it gummy and thick. The paste caused his throat to swell, and swallowing became a chore. Even as he walked across thick, almost muddy soil, his captor would not remove his hood. He would not tell the priest why he was brought here. It was not until Father Bradbury had been taken into a structure of some kind that he was given any information at all. Unfortunately, not all of the communication was verbal, and none of it was encouraging. Father Bradbury was led onto a rug and was ordered to stand there. The man who had brought the priest in released him. Through the hood, he saw a gauzy spot of light directly ahead.
"May I have a drink?"
Father Bradbury rasped. The priest heard a high whistling sound from behind. A moment later, there was a sharp snapping sound, followed by a blaze of intense heat behind both knees. The fire jumped up through Father Bradbury's thighs and down to his ankles like an electric shock. He sucked a deep, involuntary breath. At the same time, his legs folded, and he dropped to his knees. When he was finally able to let the air from his lungs, he moaned miserably. The burning grew worse as he lay there. He knew at once that he had been struck with a switch. After several moments, he was hoisted roughly back to his feet and cuffed on the side of the head to get his attention.
"Do not speak," someone ordered.
The speaker was standing a few feet in front of the priest. His voice was soft but commanding. Father Bradbury's ear was ringing from the blow. He turned the side of his head toward the man who had just spoken. There was something compelling about his voice. The hands released him after a moment. The priest wobbled but forced himself to remain standing. The only sound the priest heard was his own breathing, and then, after a minute or two, the man in front spoke again.
"I want you to do something," said the speaker in front.
"Who are you?"
Father Bradbury implored. The words were cracked. It did not sound like his own voice. A moment later, he heard the terrible whistle. He cried out as he felt the bite of the switch. This time, it struck a little higher, along the backs of his thighs. The pain was so great that he actually danced forward several steps before collapsing. He fell on the dirt floor, panting and whimpering. The priest lay writhing on his belly, hooting pain into the hood. He could not control what came from his mouth. His bound hands pulled against the ropes, but Father Bradbury was not trying to get free. His body had to move to keep from letting the pain be his only stimulus. He barely knew what he was doing anymore. He was struggling mightily with his bonds, yet he had never felt so weak. The switch nipped the backs of his bound hands. Father Bradbury yelped and stopped moving them. He was pulled back onto his feet. His knees folded inward, but the priest did not fall. Powerful hands continued to hold him.
"You must believe me," said the gentleman in front.
He was leaning close again, his voice even more compassionate now.
"I do not wish to hurt you. On my soul, I do not. The creation of pain is a black deed. It hurts you, and it attracts the attention of evil spirits. They feed on evil, and they grow stronger. Then they attempt to influence us. That is not what I wish. But for the sake of my people, I must have your cooperation." "Now," the voice said as the man stepped away, "you will be taken to a telephone. We have been watching your 7 deacon missionaries. We have the numbers of their cellular telephones. You will call them and tell these men to leave my country. When their departure has been confirmed, you will be permitted to leave our camp. Then you too will leave our Botswana, you and the other priests of a false divinity."
"He is not false,"
Father Bradbury said. The clergyman braced for a blow that did not come. Then it came, just as he was relaxing. It struck his lower back. He felt the shock of the blow race up his back to his neck, and he whimpered loudly. No one said anything. There was no need. He knew the rules. The hands holding Father Bradbury were joined by another set of hands. They pulled the priest forward. He could not keep his wounded legs under him. He did not even try. The priest was dragged across the room. His legs were screaming, but he could do nothing to quiet them. One set of hands pushed him onto a stool. Another man untied the bottom of the hood. It was lifted to just above the priest's mouth. As warm as the evening was, the air felt wonderfully cool on his face.
"There's a speakerphone in front of you," said someone close to Father Bradbury.
This was the man who had originally captured him. The first person we are calling is Deacon Jones. No one was holding the priest now. He slumped forward slightly, but he did not slip from the stool. You will tell him to return to the church, collect his belongings, and go home, his captor told him. If you say anything else, we will end the call and you will be beaten.
Sir,
Father Bradbury croaked,
I am Botswanan. So is Deacon Jones. I will not tell him to leave.
The switch came down across his slender shoulders. The heavy blow snapped the priest erect and bent him backward. His mouth flew open, but he made no sound. The pain paralyzed his vocal cords and his lungs. He sat there frozen, arched away from the telephone. After a few seconds, the little air that was left in his lungs wheezed out. His shoulders relaxed slowly. His head fell forward. The pain of the blow settled in as a now familiar heat. Father Bradbury nodded.
I still will not say what you want.
The priest expected another blow. Instead of striking him, someone retied the hood under his chin. Then he lifted the prisoner to his feet. His legs seemed to be disconnected, and the priest began to drop. The man grabbed the meat of his upper arms and held him tightly. It hurt, but not as much as the rest of him. The priest was dragged back outside. He was taken to another structure and tossed roughly inside. His hands were still tied behind him, so he tucked his head into his chest to protect it from a fall to the floor. The fall never came. Father Bradbury struck a corrugated metal wall and bounced back toward the door. He landed against metal bars that had been shut so quickly they literally pinned him to the wall. His legs were still wobbly, but that did not matter. His body sagged but did not drop. There was no room. He tried to wriggle to the left and right, but that was not possible. The side walls were as far apart as his aching shoulders.
Lord God,
he murmured when he realized he was in a cell. A cell so small that he would not be able to sit, let alone sleep. Washington, D.C., Tuesday, 5:55 p.m. Bob Herbert had just returned to his office when the desk phone beeped. His assistant, Stacy, told him that Edgar Klein was calling. Herbert was surprised to hear the name. The men had worked together in the early 1980s. That was when the Johannesburg native first joined the South African Secret Service. They shared information about terrorist training grounds on the African coast along the Indian Ocean. Klein resigned from the group in 1987 when he discovered that SAS sources were being used to spy on anti-apartheid advocates working abroad. The operative was a devout Catholic who did not approve of apartheid or any exclusionary form of government. Klein moved to Rome and joined the Vatican Security Organization, the VSO, where Herbert lost touch with him.
How the hell are you, Edgar?
Very well, Klein told him. What about you, Robert?
I'm still cleaning up after the yakety-yak diplomats, Herbert replied. Where are you calling from?
At the moment, from a commercial airliner en route to Washington, Klein told him.
Oh, does that mean I'm going to get to see you? Herbert asked.
Actually, while I realize this is rather short notice, I was wondering if you might be free for supper.
If I weren't, I would make myself free.
Excellent, Klein said. I'm staying at the Watergate. I should be there about 8 o'clock. I'll be in the same room I had back on February 22 of 84. We'll order room service.
Well, fine, as long as you're picking up the check.
Of course, the Lord provides, Klein said.
Herbert hung up. Klein had not stayed at the Watergate in 1984. That was how they used to communicate room numbers or house addresses of terrorists. The date signified the number. In this case, February 22 meant that Klein was staying in room 222. Obviously, the VSO operative did not want Herbert asking for him. That meant he was not traveling under his real name. Herbert wondered what kind of crisis could require such precautions. Whatever it was, it must have come up suddenly. Otherwise, Klein would have at least let Herbert know he was coming. While Herbert pondered the problem, he happened to glance down to his right, to the pocket in his wheelchair. To something he had forgotten. To a possible answer to his question. Okavango Swamp, Botswana, Wednesday, 1:40 a.m. The hut was bank vault dark, and the air was as stuffy and still. However hot he was, though, Henry Genet was certain of one thing. The stubborn Father Bradbury was warmer. Dressed only in briefs, the bald 5-foot-9-inch Genet sat down on the 48-inch canvas cot. The bed was surrounded by a heavy white nylon lace mosquito net that hung from a bamboo umbrella and reached to the wooden floor. The trappings were completely alien to the Belgian native. So was this remote swamp, this distant nation, this vast continent. But the 53-year-old was thrilled to be here. The son of a diamond merchant, Genet had lived in and around Antwerp most of his life. Despite the history, the culture, and the conveniences, Antwerp existed for finance. So did Genet. Though he loved acquisition, it had ceased to become a challenge. That was why he had put together the group. The others were as bored as he was, and boredom was one of the reasons they had come here. Genet used the edges of his pillow to wipe sweat from his eyes. He turned gently onto his belly so the perspiration would run out on its own. Then he thought about Dumbala, and he had to smile. 8 months before, Dumbala had been associated with Genet in a much different capacity. Then, the 33-year-old Botswanan was known as Thomas Burton. He was a sifter in a mine Genet visited each month to do some of his buying. Thomas had worked at the very end of the trough line, and he had a voice that could be heard over the rushing water and the hum of the fan. Genet knew this because every day, promptly at 2 o'clock, Thomas would speak about the ages-old teachings of Vous deux, or you two. While continuing to sift, the young man would extemporize on the beauty of life and death in their relation to the universe. It was only upon his return to Antwerp that Henry Genet discovered what Thomas Burton was talking about. As Genet drifted into sleep, he recalled how, over dinner, he had been discussing the speeches with 5 other businessmen. When Genet was finished, one of the men, Albert Baudin, sat back and smiled. Baudin was a 70-year-old French industrialist who had his hand in a variety of businesses.
"Do you have any idea what you witnessed?"
Baudin asked.
"You saw a papa giving a sermon about Bon Dieu," the elderly industrialist explained.
"Who was doing what about whom?" asked Richard Becquet, one of the other merchants.
"A papa is a priest, and Bon Dieu is his supreme deity," Bondier said. "What you heard were lectures in Vodunism, the religion of white and black arts, of good magic and evil magic."
And suddenly, Genet understood. Voodoo was better known by its anglicized name, voodoo. Henry Genet and the other men at that meeting also understood something else. That what the Belgian had witnessed was like the mines he visited. The voodoo faith was deeper, older, and richer than most people knew. All it needed was for someone to tap its wealth, to speak directly to its traditional adherents and potential converts, to unleash its power. Washington, D.C., Tuesday, 8 p.m. Bob Herbert rapped on the door of room 222 at the Watergate Hotel. A tall man with a lantern jaw and short blonde hair answered. Klein smiled and offered his hand. Herbert rolled into the foyer and shut the door before accepting it. He glanced quickly around the room. Now Herbert turned toward Klein and shook his hand.
"It's good to see you, Robert," Klein said.
Klein spoke with the same reserve Herbert remembered so well. Klein smiled his polite smile and gestured toward the main room.
"Would you like a drink?"
"A Coke would be nice," Herbert said as he wheeled himself in.
"I promised you dinner," Klein said. "Shall I call for it?"
"I'm okay for now," Herbert said. "Just a Coke and an update."
"So, why are you here?"
"To talk to Cardinal Zavala here in Washington and Cardinal Brugheta in New York," he replied as he handed the Coke to Herbert. "We need to get more American missionaries into the field in Southern Africa."
"Quickly, I assume," Herbert said. Klein nodded. Then he began to pace the room.
"We are facing a potentially explosive situation in Africa, Robert, and I do not mean just the Vatican."
"You're talking about the incident yesterday with Father Bradbury,"
Herbert said. Yes, Father Poe's Bradbury was abducted by a militia that was led by someone who we believe is Leon Soronga. Do you know that name?
Doesn't spark anything.
Soronga is a former Botswana soldier who helped to organize the Brush Vipers. They were a very effective intelligence unit that helped Botswana break away from Great Britain. Soronga was spotted 2 weeks ago at the Botswana village of Machaneng. He was attending a rally held by a religious leader named Dampala.
Is that his real name? Herbert asked as he unfolded his computer.
It's a variant spelling of the name of a god of the Vodun faith. We do not know more than that. And we do not have direct access to him, nor is his image in our file.
Herbert asked Klein for the spelling of the name. He made a note of it in a new computer file.
We routinely watch all religious movements in Africa. We like to know whether they originate at a grassroots level or elsewhere. Sects concealing a political agenda tend to be well-financed, often from abroad. They're a danger to the political stability of the continent.
I understand.
After we'd ID'd Soronga, we went back and checked photographs from previous Dambala rallies, Klein went on. Soronga was not the only member of the former Brush Vipers to have been present.
I see, which is really why you came to Washington. If this is the start of a new political action in southern Africa, you want Americans to help contain it.
Let's just say I'd like you to participate in the process of containment. That can take many forms, though right now I need intelligence.
Well, Edgar, do you have any idea why Father Bradbury was targeted? Was there something special about his ministry?
Father Bradbury presides over the largest number of deacon missionaries in the nation.
Oh, and I assume no one at the Vatican has received a ransom demand?
Klein shook his head.
That means the kidnappers need him. Do you have any idea where they're taking Father Bradbury?
No, and it wasn't for lack of trying. This was a well-planned operation, but we have no idea to what end.
But one thing I don't see is Botswana complicity with this militia. The economy is strong and the government stable. They'd have nothing to gain by this.
I agree. So, what does that leave us with? Are we facing some kind of religious-military hybrid? The Brush Vipers fought to obtain the independence Botswana now enjoys. Why would they want to be involved with a potentially destabilizing force?
Well, I'm not sure, but I researched some of our databases before coming here. The Brush Vipers were one of four paramilitary groups that used to operate in that region of Botswana. Do you know where they got their weapons from?
Not from the Botswana military, I hope.
No. Worse.
They came from someone we dealt with years ago.
Who?
The musketeer, Herbert replied. Albert Baudin.
Okavango Swamp, Botswana, Wednesday, 5:58 a.m.
Once again, Father Bradbury was brought to a structure of some kind.
Bring him closer,
someone said from in front of him. It was the man who had spoken to him the night before, the man with the gentle voice.
It sounded even calmer now. The priest wondered if it were the voice of a man who had just finished morning prayer.
Father Bradbury was urged forward. He tried hard to keep his legs under him. He failed. Sweat was collecting in the bottom of the hood. It was pooling faster than the fabric could absorb it.
Have you changed your mind? The voice asked.
No, the priest replied. His voice was a rough whisper.
I would never recall missionaries who are doing God's work.
Never? I am certain you would warn your people of an impending flood or hurricane.
Yes,
Father Bradbury agreed.
But so they could help others, not save themselves.
But you would not want them to stay and perish.
you would tell the missionaries to leave because life is dear. Well, your people are in danger. The gods want this land restored to them, and their people returned to the olden temples. I am going to give the gods what they want.
What about the wishes of the people? Bradbury asked.
You hear their confessions. You know what many wish. They wish to sin. They wish to have an easy life. It is for the heralds of the gods to teach them a better way.
Not everyone wants those things.
You are in no position to say that.
I know my parish.
You do not know my parish, the man shot back. It is also for you to decide only whether you and your missionaries will be alive to preach elsewhere. Do not act from pride, but with wisdom.
I can't think,
Father Bradbury muttered. You're not being asked to think. Make the telephone calls, and then you will be fed and permitted to rest. When you are refreshed, you will understand that you acted wisely. You will save lives.
My job is to save souls, the priest replied.
Then live and save them somewhere else.
Even if Father Bradbury had the will to fight, he was not sure exactly what he was fighting for or against. The man was right about one thing. He needed a clearer head. He needed time. And there was only one way to get that.
All right, Father Bradbury said. I will do as you ask. I will make your calls.
The priest felt hands working around his neck. He eagerly anticipated the removal of the hood. It only came up part way. The men tugged the front only as high as the top of his mouth. They lifted the right side above his ear. The cool air felt like a breath from heaven. He was walked forward and gently lowered to his knees. He was given a short sip of warm water from a canteen.
The first call is to Deacon Jones, another man told him.
Father Bradbury recognized the voice. It was the gruff-throated man who had brought him to his room the previous night. Strong hands continued to hold his shoulders as numbers were punched. The priest was told to say that he was being well cared for. Then he was to give the deacon missionaries their instructions. He was to tell each missionary that he would join them soon at the diocese in Cape Town. He was to reveal absolutely nothing more. Deacon Jones answered the phone. The young man was excited and relieved to hear from the priest. In as clear and firm a voice as he could generate, Father Bradbury instructed the missionary to return immediately to the compound, pack, and go to Cape Town.
What is it?
Deacon Jones asked.
What is happening?
I will explain when I see you,
the priest replied. He felt a reassuring squeeze on his shoulders.
As you wish,
Jones replied. The deacon had never disputed the priest's judgment. When Father Bradbury was finished making the calls, he was taken to a wicker chair. The priest waited for the mask to be removed and his hands to be untied. Instead, he heard another chair moved beside him.
You will be given water and food now, said the man who had done most of the talking. Then you will be allowed to sleep.
Wait,
said the priest.
You told me I would be released.
You will be set free when your work is finished, the man assured Father Bradbury.
But I did as you asked,
the priest protested. Father Bradbury heard a door shut. A canteen was once again pressed to the priest's lips.
Drink it, or else I will,
the gruff-voiced man said from beside him.
I have things to do.
Father Bradbury put his mouth around the warm metal. He drank as slowly as a thirsty man could. Then he sat while the man fed him pieces of banana, papaya, and melon. Washington, D.C., Wednesday, 6 a.m., Paul Hood was shaving when Bob Herbert called. The intelligence chief was already at Op Center. They had spoken about Edgar Klein just a few hours before. Hood had told Herbert that they should give the Vatican representative any support he required.
I just got a call from Ed Klein, Herbert said. Poet Bradbury's been working the phones. He telephoned each of his deacon missionaries, the guys in the field, and told them to pack up and go back to the diocese in Cape Town.
Well, did Father Bradbury give a reason for recalling the missionaries? Hood asked.
None. Klein got the records of calls that were placed to the missionaries' cell phones.
And?
Nada. The number was blocked. Matt Stoll says somebody probably hacked the local computers to erase the number as soon as it appeared. Or maybe it was blocked on the caller's end. Our own taxats do that.
Which means these people have some technological talent either in the group or available to them, Hood said.
Right. We'll have to wait for this Dambala guy to surface again before proceeding. In the meantime, we should get people into Botswana. We will need intelligence resources on the ground. Before he hung up, Herbert had one thing to add. When I came in this morning, there was a voicemail message from Shigeo Fujima.
I know that name, Hood said.
He's the head of the Intelligence and Analysis Bureau of Gaimusho, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Fujima did the Japanese security follow-up on our North Korea operation.
That's right, Hood said.
Fujima wanted to know if we had any information on a guy named Henry Genet.
Who is?
A member of the board of directors of Bodan International Industries, Herbert said. But that's not all he does. Genet spends a lot of time in Africa pursuing his main business.
Which is?
Diamonds.
Washington, D.C., Thursday, 8 a.m. DiMaggio's Joe was not the kind of place where spies did business. It was public, brightly lit, watched by security cameras, heavily trafficked, and generally loud. That was precisely why Mike Rogers asked Aideen Marley, David Batat, and Daryl McCaskey to meet him there. Batat was the only out-of-towner. The former CIA officer promised to take the first shuttle down from LaGuardia and cab right over Thursday morning. Rogers was the first to arrive. Daryl got there a few minutes later. The short, wiry, prematurely gray ex-FBI man looked tired. His leathery face was pale, and his blue eyes were bloodshot.
You look like you haven't slept, Rogers said.
McCaskey sat down with two double espressos and two raisin biscottis.
Not much, he admitted.
There's stuff with Maria, he said. The 38-year-old Maria Corneja, a Spanish Interpol agent, had recently married Daryl McCaskey. McCaskey was Op Center's national and foreign intelligence liaison. He had returned to Washington while Maria settled her affairs in Madrid. She would be joining her husband in a week.
What kind of stuff? Rogers asked.
She's worried, McCaskey said.
About being married or coming to the U.S.?
I don't know. Everything, I guess, McCaskey grumbled. Maria's afraid she'll have a really tough time getting adjusted to suburban D.C. and then finding something interesting to do.
I thought she was ready for a break, Rogers said.
So did she.
Did something change her mind?
Yeah. Bob called her early this morning.
Bob called Maria?
Maria Corneja was on his own short list of operatives to call on, and Herbert knew that. Something must have happened over there, or he would not have contacted her.
Well, what did he want? Rogers asked.
He needed Maria to check on something at the Ministry of Defense.
You have any idea what it was?
Haven't a clue, but it didn't matter to Maria. She called me from her old office. She was psyched because she knew which people to talk to at the ministry. She knew the area, and she knew exactly where to look. She felt plugged in.
She spent her life there, Rogers said. And going back home right before you leave somewhere, that's rough.
I know, McCaskey said. But she also isn't a kid. She wakes me up with a call that goes something like, Daryl, I may have made a mistake. I don't know if I can give this up.
McCaskey leaned in closer.
There was a rumor going around the clubhouse yesterday that you're going to spearhead a new human operation.
Is that true?
Rogers nodded. Herbert must have slipped McCaskey the word. The intelligence chief hated keeping a brother at arms in the dark.
McCaskey sat back.
Damn, Mike. I would have appreciated some kind of heads up.
You would have gotten that today, right now, Rogers said. That's why I asked to see you this morning.
Christ, Paul just hit me with this new operation.
McCaskey scowled.
Listen, Daryl, we can talk about this later, Rogers said. I asked you here to tell you about the Hument Group, because I may need help from some of your people in D.C. and abroad.
And why did you want me to meet at this place instead of the office?
McCaskey asked. Because two other people are joining us, Rogers said. I want to see how they conduct themselves in public. As if on cue, Rogers saw Aideen Marley enter the shop. Actually, the first thing he saw was the young woman's brilliant red hair. It was longer than he remembered, framing a face that was not as full as he remembered. 34-year-old Aideen Marley was a former Foreign Service officer who had worked with Maria Corneja, averting a Spanish Civil War 2 years before. Now she was working as a political consultant for both Ops Center and the State Department. Rogers waved to her, and both men stood. Aideen weaved through the crowd. The smile she wore was genuine. That, too, was a rarity in Washington. When Aideen arrived, she gave the general a warm hug.
How are you? She asked.
Not bad. You look terrific.
Thanks.
She turned to McCaskey and offered her hand.
I hear you got married. Congratulations. Maria is a great, great lady.
McCaskey asked Aideen if he could get anything for her. She asked if he would mind getting her a regular decaf and a croissant.
I had 3 cups of coffee before I left home and another on the way, she said as she slid onto a stool. I get up and do most of my work when it's still dark out. Better for the concentration. I research and write my Moore Cook Journal articles when my brain is still fresh, then cram for the day's meetings.
The Moore Cook Journal is a quarterly about the impact of international affairs on domestic policy, widely read in the intelligence industry.
I was thinking on the way over. We haven't seen each other in over a year. How are you, Mike? Aideen asked.
Okay. I assume you heard about the trouble in Kashmir. The woman nodded once.
I was sorry to hear about that. How's Colonel August?
He's fine. That mission was my call. My black mark. Besides, he's always been able to look ahead.
While you look back?
What can I say? I'm a history buff. There were budget cuts. That's how I lost Stryker, too.
Not just the personnel. You mean the group?
Rogers nodded. Which is one of the reasons I asked you to come down here today. McCaskey returned with Aideen's decaf. I'm putting together a new group, Rogers said quietly. Very low profile, doing the same kind of work you did with Maria. I was wondering if you'd consider being a part of it. She looked from Rogers to McCaskey.
Will Maria be working with us? She asked.
We don't know yet.
I do, McCaskey replied.
When Mike asks that question, Maria won't hesitate. Not like she did when I popped mine. Before they could discuss the team further, David Batat entered the cafe. Rogers recognized him from his file photo and motioned him over. The general did not know what to expect from the man. 43-year-old David Batat was the former director of a CIA field office in New York City. Batat had recently returned to Manhattan after helping Op Center stop a terrorist from sabotaging oil supplies in Azerbaijan. The former CIA agent was short and scrappy, with none of the boot camp polish to which Rogers was accustomed. But the general was not dealing with the military any longer. Batat reached the table. He was wearing a New York University sweatshirt and had the New York Times under his arm. He carried nothing else. Rogers liked a man who traveled light. Batat brushed back his short, thinning black hair. He introduced himself to Rogers and McCaskey. Rogers introduced Aideen. Batat's heavy eyebrows rose behind his sunglasses. You must be the Aideen Marley who writes for the MCJ, Batat said.
That's me.
I read your article on the impact of media hysteria on civic anti-terrorist preparedness, Batat said. We'll have to discuss it.
Oh, you don't agree with my findings? She asked.
I do, as far as they go. He pulled a stool underneath him and sat down. You can't anticipate and preempt assaults. All you do is panic people, which can be worse than an attack itself. Hell, it is an attack itself.
A mock attack?
Psychological assaults are not pretend assaults.
No, but they are easier to defend against, she suggested.
What's your solution?
My solution is an aggressive offense. An enemy hits a building, you knock out a city block. They hit a city block, you wipe out an entire town or city. They hit a city, you turn the country to a landfill.
What's wrong with the legal system handling the aftermath of an attack? Because that gives them a podium from which to spout their BS. I mean, who needs that?
We will have to discuss this, Aideen said.
David, can I get you anything? McCaskey asked. I mean, apart from a tactical nuclear weapon?
I'm good, Batat said. They gave out cookies on the plane.
He looked at Rogers.
How've you been?
I read about what happened overseas.
You did us proud.
Thanks, Rogers said. I was just telling Ms. Marley that because of what happened, we've been forced to make a few changes. We're putting together a different kind of sports team, and I'm sounding out possible players.
I'm in, Batat told him.
That's it?
McCaskey said.
That's it.
Great, Rogers said. He looked at Aideen. What about you?
She hesitated before replying. I'm very interested. I'd like to discuss this some more.
Sure, Rogers said. What I suggest is that we go back to the office and have a real chat. Aideen nodded.
Question, Batat said. When were you thinking of fielding this team, just so I can work out things schedule-wise?
Rogers finished his coffee and looked at his watch.
He replied, in about 6 hours.
Washington, D.C., Thursday, 8:12 a.m. The list of people Bob Herbert trusted was short. The list of people he trusted absolutely was shorter still. Edgar Klein was never on the very short list. Now, Herbert was not sure he was on the short list. Klein also had self-interest to protect. The well-being of the Vatican and its inner circle was his top priority. Herbert understood and respected that. But Herbert also had interest to look after. Herbert had arranged for Klein to come to Op Center at 8 a.m. and brief Hood. Herbert greeted his old friend at the main level and took him directly to Hood's office. Klein sat in the armchair in front of Hood's desk. Herbert parked his wheelchair inside the door. Hood had also asked his political liaison, Ron Plummer, to attend the meeting. Klein said that he had met with Cardinal Zavala before Mass this morning. When he was finished here, he was going directly to New York to meet with Cardinal Murrieta.
Did you get what you wanted from the Cardinal? Herbert asked.
I did, Klein told him.
We arranged to have Bishop Victor Max go to Botswana. He's going to take Father Bradbury's place in a show of support. He will fly to Gaborone and then take a shuttle to Maun. We've asked two of the deacons not to leave but to meet him there.
What kind of precautions are you arranging for the bishop's security? Hood asked.
We are working with local authorities, Klein said.
Is that all?
Klein regarded the intelligence chief.
We have other options open to us, he replied. The bishop will be safe.
I'm betting you've invoked the Madrid Accords.
It was the first time Herbert had ever seen Edgar Klein seem surprised.
You've been busy.
Oh, we both have, Herbert replied.
Back up, Hood said. I'm not familiar with the Accords.
3 years ago, the Vatican signed a secret agreement with the Ministerio de Defensa de España. In exchange for aggressive support from the Vatican, the prince promised to provide ground troops in the event of action undertaken against the church in any developing country.
Klein waved his hand dismissively.
The Madrid Accords are not a secret, he said.
Not if you happen to read the Fraternal Vatican Minutes, which are not available outside the Hall of Records in Rome. I only know about the arrangement because at 2:15 this morning I called one of our people in Spain. I asked her to look into the existence of any such agreements.
What prompted you to do that? Klein asked.
A visit you had from Deputy Chief of Ministry Rodriguez very early this morning, Herbert replied.
Klein's pleasant features darkened.
You had me watched?
That's right, Herbert replied evenly.
The involvement of the Spanish military is a very delicate aspect of this situation, Klein said. The Vatican does not have a defense arrangement with the Spanish military. It is only with the Grupo del Cuartel General, UED.
Well, that's the Spanish military's equivalent to Stryker.
Correct. The only time we ever expected to call on them is if there were an imminent threat against His Holiness or the Vatican itself. I didn't tell you about their involvement because they're not going into Botswana in an official capacity.
They're going to Father Bradbury's parish in Maun as tourists, Herbert replied. Klein seemed even more surprised than he had been a minute before. I had our computer group check flights from Spain to Botswana. Reservations for several Spanish men came up on the hop from Valencia to Madrid and then to Gaborone. The names were aliases, but they used their personal telephone numbers for e-ticket security. That data was in the Pentagon's files from last year's war sim exercises on the Mediterranean. You knew more than I did, Klein remarked. There was resentment in his voice. Now that everything is on the table, Mr. Klein, Hood said, what would you like from us? This is not so much a Vatican issue, but a potential problem for Botswana and the rest of the region. We do not know whether Albert Baudin is involved in this movement. If he is, it's extremely doubtful. He is there for religious enlightenment. He would want to stir things up for his own reasons, Hood said. Klein nodded. Can Dumbala afford to let Bishop Max take up where Father Bradbury left off? Hood asked. We don't know. The church is not willing to give up its missionary activities in Botswana or anywhere else. Hood turned to his political advisor. Ron, what kind of ramifications are we looking at if there's a civil war in Botswana? A politically based war would be bad enough, Plummer said, but if we have a religious uprising, a situation where non-Christians are turning on Catholics, the Hindu and Islamic minorities in South Africa could be inspired or encouraged into doing the same thing. And make no mistake, if there is a conflict in the region, Johannesburg would have to move very quickly to shut the border and protect its people, its workforce. Turmoil in South African industry would affect regional supplies of steel, corn, wool, metals, and the international market for diamonds. Hood and Herbert exchanged glances at the mention of diamonds. Klein did not appear to notice. One well-placed flame and the entire region could blow up, Plummer said. It will be pulled in so many directions, political, religious, economic, and social, that it will be impossible to find the original pieces, let alone reassemble them. All right, let's back up, Hood said. Does the Botswana president, what's his name? Butere, Klein said. Michael Butere. Does President Butere know about the possible involvement of the Brush Vipers and foreign interests in Dumbala's activities? Hood asked. We have told him about the possible involvement of former Brush Vipers. We have not said anything to the president about Albert Baudin. Why not? Herbert asked. The Botswana government might be the ultimate target. We're more concerned about the Vatican's relations with France, Klein said. We absolutely do not want to implicate a leading French industrialist until we're convinced that he's involved. Hood looked over at Plummer. Suggestions, Ron? I have two, Plummer replied. First, Op Center should move with considerable caution. Anything we do has to be extremely low profile, invisible if possible. Well, I agree, Herbert said. Having said that, Plummer went on, we can't afford to let this blow up. As long as we have an exit strategy for our personnel and our involvement, we should give Mr. Klein any and all the intelligence support he requires. Hood's gaze shifted to Herbert. Bob, how do we prep for that? Well, we can put someone in with the Spanish tourists, Herbert said. Edgar, do you think there would be a problem with that? If the UED commander doesn't protest, I'm certain the Vatican will have no objections, Klein told him. Who did you have in mind for the undercover operation? A woman who just retired from Interpol and is probably entitled to a few weeks of vacation, Herbert replied. Maun, Botswana, Thursday, 4:30 p.m. 38-year-old Deacon Elliot Jones had arrived at the Church of the Holy Cross shortly after 2 p.m. It had taken him more than a day to make his way northwest from Tonota on the Zimbabwe border. From Maun, he had to catch the bus to the tourist center, where the church was located. There, he and Deacon Cannon would link up. They would make preparations to leave Botswana. Just minutes after he finally reached the church, he received a call from the Archdiocese in Cape Town. There was a change of plans.
Jones was to go to Maon the following afternoon. Only he would not be flying to South Africa. He was to wait for the arrival of Bishop Victor Max from Washington, D.C., and bring him back to the church. The personal secretary of Archbishop Patrick in Cape Town also instructed Jones to bring one other deacon with him. Apart from Deacon Jones, Deacon Samuel Holden Cannon had made the longest journey. His ministry encompassed a string of villages on the 6,000-foot-high Sodilo Hill, which stood where Botswana, Namibia, and Angola all met in the northwest. Jones relayed the archbishop's instructions to the 24-year-old deacon. Cannon said he would be honored to accompany Deacon Jones to Maon. The men went to the quarters the deacons used whenever they came in from the field. After removing their dirty soutans and showering away the dust of the journey, the men put on fresh cassocks. Deacon Jones made tea in the small kitchen area and then took it out onto the veranda. The two men sat in wicker chairs and looked out at the flat, sprawling floodplain. The afternoon was as dry, warm, and windless as usual for this time of year. The sky was cloudless, and the amber sun was low. The men sat in silence then as they sipped their tea. The sun dropped, and the air cooled quickly. The chill felt good. The silence, settled upon such vastness, was humbling. Deacon Jones's cell phone beeped. He jumped from the sound and quickly pulled the phone from the pocket of his cassock. He expected it to be the archbishop's secretary. It was not. It was Father Bradbury, with a surprising request. Washington, D.C., Thursday, 9:55 a.m. Hood brought up Shigeo Fujima's file. He scanned it quickly. The man was 35, married, two children. He had been with the Intelligence and Analysis Bureau for 7 years. The man obviously had intelligence chops and political savvy. To be the head of the IAB at such a young age was very impressive. After checking Fujima's file, Hood brought up the dossier on Henry Genet. Hood punched in the telephone number Fujima had left on Herbert's voicemail. "Thank you for calling back, Mr. Hood," Fujima said. "I'm honored the director of Op Center would call personally." "Your call interested me personally," Hood replied. "You had questions about Henry Genet?" When the Japanese intelligence officer spoke, it was with care and precision. "We have been watching Mr. Henry Genet because of several recent investment and business undertakings," Fujima began. "Over the past few months, he has increased the hiring of personnel in Botswana. At least, that is what it says on the tax forms filed in Gaborone." "What kind of personnel is he supposed to have hired?" Hood asked. "Diamond buyers. Security personnel for his purchases, scouts for new purchases. In other words, the kind of employees that would not raise any flags," Hood said. "Yes. Yet we saw no evidence of such personnel in our surveillance. During that same period, Genet has also withdrawn nearly $100 million from banks in Japan, Taiwan, and the United States. He has used some of that money to lease large tracts of land and invest in factories in both China and North Korea." "That could simply be an investment decision," Hood said. "The Chinese economy is expected to grow exponentially over the next 20 years. "A reasonable assumption. Except that Mr. Genet established several international holding companies to share the ownership of the property and apparently to conceal his involvement." "What are the names of the companies?" Hood asked. "The only one we know is called Eye at Sea," he replied. "We believe that Mr. Albert Baudin is part of that investment group. He should not have to conceal his participation. It is not illegal for Frenchmen to invest in China." "Where in China has Genet leased land?" Hood asked. "The property is in Shenyang in the Liaoning province," Fujima replied. "Well, that's where the Chinese manufacture their advanced J-82 fighter jets," Hood said. "That's right. And that is why the purchase concerns us. They have a highly skilled, relatively inexpensive labor pool there. An international munitions manufacturer could make a great deal of money using that talent. Obviously, it's an area of enterprise that Japan must watch closely." Hood went back to the computer file on the Baudin corporate structure. He reviewed the biographies of each individual. The entries were short. "Have the other members of Baudin's team made any significant financial transactions?" Hood asked.
To date, we have only been watching Mr. Genet and Mr. Baudin, the intelligence officer replied. But consider some of the names on Baudin's board. Richard Becquet, Robert Stiele, Gurney De Silva, Peter Diffring. Are any of them familiar to you? I have very thin files, Hood said. I'll forward them when we're done. They all appear to be low-profile French, Belgian, and German financiers. These are extremely low-profile gentlemen. Indirectly, through partnerships and through individuals who follow their investment leads, they control $4 to $5 billion. We cannot ignore the potential for at least a financial assault on international economies. Fujima's use of the term at least suggested his greater worry, that the European money, along with Baudin technology, would be used to enhance the already formidable Chinese military machine. Hood received an instant message from Bugs Benet. Emmy Faroche was on the line. Hood wrote back and asked him to have her hold on. Mr. Fujima, I'm going to look into these developments for you, Hood said. Bob Herbert or I will keep you informed. I hope you will do the same. I will, Fujima promised. Hood told Bugs to forward the personnel files of the Baudin board to Mr. Fujima. Then he grabbed the call from Emmy. Sorry to keep you waiting, Emmy. Emmy Faroche had worked with Hood on Wall Street at Silver Sachs. Now she worked for the FBI's finance division, investigating white-collar crime. Not a problem, Paul, she said. It's great to hear from you. How is the world of white-collar crime? Overall, it's very busy. At the moment, it's completely insane. We're checking to see if there were any improprieties in several major stock deals. Have you ever heard of a German stockbroker named Robert Stiele? Hood felt a chill. It so happens I have. What did he do? Stiele quietly pulled the trigger on some major deals early this morning, Euro time. He dumped $114 million in blue-chip stock holdings, companies that were doing well, and put the money into three separate privately held operations. Do you have their names? Hood asked. Yes. The first one is VB Limited, the second one is Les Jambes de Venus, and the third is I at Sea, Hood said. Yes, Emmy replied. She was obviously impressed. How do you know that? I can't tell you. Well, Mr. Wizard, what can you tell me? Look into Albert Baudin. Why? Can't tell you that either. What are you doing about Stiele? We're trying to find out if Mr. Stiele knows something about the blue chips that we don't. I wouldn't worry about the blue chips, Hood said. This is about Stiele. He needed to get liquid. Why? That, Hood replied, is a damn good question. Okavango Swamp, Botswana, Thursday, 6 p.m. Father Bradbury was awakened by a firm tap on the shoulder and a gruff, unfamiliar voice. Get up! It was now very dark in the room. He had no idea how long he'd been asleep. The priest felt incredibly groggy. He did not want to move, let alone stand. Come on, the voice said. Father Bradbury was taken inside a hut. Dumbala was sitting on a wicker mat by the far wall. His back was to the door. There was a candle in front of him. It gave off a tart smell like burning rubber. It was the only light in the room. There was a wooden bucket behind the man. The soldier sat the priest in a folding chair in the center of the room. There was a tray on the dirt floor to Father Bradbury's right. On it were a cell phone, a plate of fruit, a pitcher of water, and a glass.
You may drink or eat, if you wish, Dumbala said.
He spoke without turning around. Father Bradbury filled the water glass and took a banana.
You did both, Dumbala remarked, but I gave you a choice.
The priest put the banana back.
You kept the water, Dumbala said. People will always choose drink over food.
Thirst is a more commanding need, I would say.
No, Dumbala told him. Water is the companion to air, earth, and fire.
Men always return to the four elemental forces to nurture life, to find the truth, to understand themselves.
Is that what you're doing out here? Father Bradbury asked. Searching for the truth?
Dumbala looked back. His face was dark, but his head was haloed by the candle's orange glow. He looked very young, very innocent.
I have found the truth. I am preparing to bring it to others.
Dumbala now turned around fully. He stood. Dumbala was a tall man, well over 6 feet. He was barefoot and dressed in a brown sleeveless robe that reached to his ankles.
What do you know of Vodunism? Dumbala asked.
The priest considered his words carefully.
It is an ancient set of practices. I have read that your beliefs are rooted in nature. That is part of it. Some of our practices, as you describe them, are at least 8,000 years old, Dumbala said.
Your history is great.
Our history? We are more than an accumulation of years and events.
Forgive me,
Father Bradbury said immediately.
I did not mean any disrespect. In truth, priest, you know nothing about the heart of my faith. How can you know anything? In the 15th century, your priests came to Africa. They baptized my people to save us from a profound evil. Growing up, I knew priests. I watched them. I saw how they promised the poor riches in the next life.
They are there, Father Bradbury assured him.
No, the riches are here. I saw them when I worked in the diamond mines. I watched as good Christians took our wealth from us, and the priests did nothing to stop them.
Why would we? They broke no laws, the priest observed.
They did not break your laws. I judge all men by one measure, and that is truth. When I worked in the mines, I also saw the living faith of Vodunism. I saw men who could cure the hurt, the weary, the despairing with a touch, a prayer, a potion.
He pointed a finger at Father Bradbury.
They explained to me that they practiced in secret because those whom you have converted also regard them as evil. And yet these are arts my ancestors took with them when they migrated to the Middle East. They are the skills that could very well have been used by your own Savior, Jesus Christ. White arts to heal, not black arts that hurt.
The cult leader moved forward slowly. Father Bradbury noticed there were snakes tattooed on the backs of his wrists.
My faith is as old as civilization itself. It was ancient when your religion was not yet conceived. I am the priest of the serpent spirit Dumbala. I have adopted a form of his name in tribute. My sacred task is to clean the nation of disbelievers. I must do that, or else I must prepare the way for Ogu Bodagri, the great spirit of war. He wishes to reclaim the home that was once his.
There must be a way to resolve our differences without bloodshed,
Father Bradbury said.
There is. Pick up the telephone.
Father Bradbury was caught off guard. He walked to the table and lifted the cordless receiver.
Call your parish. Speak with your deacon. Ask who is coming to the church.
The priest did so. Deacon Jones answered.
Yes, Bishop Victor Max, Jones said.
Deacon Cannon and I are going to Maun to meet his plane when it arrives.
The deacon's voice was coming from the back of the receiver. This was a portable speakerphone. Dumbala held out his hand. Father Bradbury handed him the telephone. The Vodun leader punched it off.
You see? They send one mightier in rank and from another nation, daring us to defend ourselves. They are daring me to go after him.
His eyes shifted to the soldier.
Return the priest to the hut.
The soldier took Father Bradbury by the arm. The priest tried to wrench it free.
Wait, the priest said. What is going to happen now?
Dumbala turned back toward his mat. He did not answer. Maun, Botswana, Thursday, 11:30 p.m. Deacon Jones opened his eyes with a start.
There was a knife at his throat. Behind it was a big, dark figure. The mosquito net had been neatly pulled aside, and the intruder was standing holding the tip of the knife firmly under Deacon Jones's chin. From the corner of his eye, Jones could see that the door was slightly ajar. He also saw someone standing over Deacon Cannon.
"What are your names?"
the intruder pressed.
"I am Elliot Jones, and he is Samuel Cannon," the deacon replied. "We are deacons at this church. What is going on?"
"Where's your cell phone? Tell me, or I'll let your soul out in pieces."
"The soul cannot be harmed," the deacon whimpered, "though I walk through the valley of death."
The knife pierced his forearm. The deacon screamed. The blade was worked around in a circle, digging into bone. This pain did not stop but kept going deeper into his body, as though molten lead had entered his veins. His head shook violently. His feet kicked on the bed. He could not control his body or his mind or his will.
"The phone," the intruder said. "We don't have time."
"It's inside my jacket,"
the man screamed.
"Behind the door. Oh, God, stop. Take the phone. Take it."
The intruder did not remove the knife. He continued to drive it down. Jones could feel his blood seeping into the sheets along his leg.
"What time are you meeting the bishop from America?"
the intruder demanded. Deacon Jones told him. He would have told him anything he asked. How did the Savior bear it? It was incomprehensible. The intruder removed the knife from the deacon's wrist. The deepest pain abated instantly, like waves pulling back from the shore. A moment later, the intruder put the blade to his throat and pushed down hard. Deacon Jones heard a scream from somewhere in the distance. It was not his own voice. He knew that because he could not move his mouth. He felt an electric pain in the base of his tongue. He lurched. An instant later, the pain struck the roof of his mouth. That one hurt worse as the hard palate offered resistance to the blade. Jones was still trying to speak, but all that came from his mouth were guttural grunts and gagging. Then the man reversed his hold on the hilt so that his thumb was on top. He pushed the knife to the left as though it were a paper cutter. The deacon's carotid artery was severed. Then he tore the blade back to the right. The internal and external jugular veins were cut. The pain was intensely warm and cold at the same time. Jones heard gurgling from somewhere. It took a moment for him to realize that the sounds were his. He was trying to breathe. The deacon reached for his throat, but his hands were weak, his fingers tingling. He let his arms drop to his sides. His eyes sought his attacker, but by then, he was unable to see anything. Leon Soronga looked down at the bloody shape on the bed. To his right, Donald Pavant finished cutting the throat of Deacon Cannon.
"It is done," Pavant said to him with defiance. "You had no choice. We did what was necessary."
The 33-year-old Pavant was the youngest of the brush vipers. Born and raised on the South African border, Pavant was exposed to refugees from apartheid. He believed that Africa was for native Africans and their descendants. Soronga continued to stare.
"Prince, this is the way you used to do it, the way that things must sometimes be done," Pavant said.
"I promised Dambala this would be different," Soronga said. "No killing, no black magic."
Had the clergyman answered Soronga's questions, they would have tied the men up. They would have hidden them here or in the field in a cave, away from predators. When the kidnapping of the American bishop had been accomplished, they would have instructed authorities where to find these two.
"See if there are fresh bedsheets anywhere," Soronga said.
"I will," Pavant said. "But I won't listen to you blame yourself. We are lions. These men were prey. This is the way it had to be."
Pavant was standing by a closet in the back of the room.
"I have the sheets."
Soronga decided that the bodies would be carried out into the floodplain. The sheets would be removed. They would be wrapped around stones and dropped in Lake Mitali. By dawn, there would not be much left of the deacons. Washington, D.C., Thursday, 4:35 p.m. It was a busy afternoon for Paul Hood. Not long after returning to his office, Hood received a call from Edgar Klein. The Vatican security officer reported that Deacon Jones had heard from Father Bradbury.
"You don't sound happy about that," Hood said.
"Father Bradbury asked about the parish," Klein said.
Klein went on. Unfortunately, Deacon Jones told the father that a temporary replacement was en route from Washington.
Are you going to change his travel plans?
That would signal to Damballa that we are afraid of him, Klein said. We will not do that.
What about your Spanish undercover operatives? Have they arrived?
The leader of the group is going in to introduce himself to the deacons in the morning, Klein replied. I'd also like to send over our e-file of photographs that were taken at Damballa's rallies. There are some photographs of Damballa. We thought you might be able to search your own databases on the off chance that there's a match.
Hood agreed to do so. Then he told Klein about Richard Stieler's activities. Klein did not seem overly concerned. A few minutes after Klein hung up, Hood's computer beeped. He had received a file containing the address for the Secure Vatican Security Organization website. The download came with a password to access the Damballa file. Hood forwarded the information to Stephen Veens, OpCenter's internal security chief. Veens' duties included setting up a photo analysis program for Hood. As Hood finished sending the data from the Vatican Security Organization, Emmy called.
Paul, that was a terrific lead you gave me about Albert Baudin, she told him.
It turns out Mr. Stieler wasn't the only Baudin associate who liquidated assets within the last few days.
Who else? Hood asked.
Gurney De Silva, who was another Baudin board member. He sold his minority interest in 6 different diamond mines yesterday.
How much did he net?
About $90 million. Some of the profits went into the corporation that holds Stieler's land leases in China.
So, the oil deal could be a smokescreen to keep anyone from looking too closely at China.
Absolutely, Emmy said.
As Hood was finishing up with Emmy, Mike Rogers came to the door. The general looked better than he had in weeks. He seemed energized, engaged, focused.
How's the team shaping up? Hood asked.
Aideen Marley and Dave Batat are ready to go over if we need them, Rogers said.
They got along all right?
They got along well enough, Rogers replied. They're not running off to get married, but they'll get the job done.
Hood hoped that Rogers was right. He liked to have harmony on his staff. Rogers put the emphasis on efficiency.
Don't worry about them, Paul, Rogers said. Batat knows that Aideen will be in charge. They'll be fine.
Since everything seems to be set, it's probably a good idea to get them over to Botswana. I suspect things are going to heat up when Bishop Max arrives tomorrow.
We can get Aideen and Batat on a plane today, Rogers told him. Travel documents are being prepared. Right now I've got them in Matt Stoll's section, reading what we have on the Father Bradbury situation. They're also going over files about Botswana and Albert Baudin.
When Rogers was finished, Hood brought the general up to date on his conversations with Edgar Klein and Emmy Faroche. In the middle of that briefing, Stephen Veens called.
Paul, I think you should come to Matt's office, Veens said.
What have you got?
Veens replied,
You're missing Link, I think.
As they headed toward Matt Stoll's office, Paul Hood and Mike Rogers bumped into Liz Gordon. The psychologist was chomping hard on her nicotine chewing gum. She had recently given up smoking and was having a tough time of it.
Is it the Vatican problem? Liz asked.
Hood nodded.
You might want to tag along if you have the time.
Matt Stoll's space was different from the other offices. When he first came to Op Center, Stoll had commandeered a small conference room. He proceeded to fill it with a haphazard arrangement of desks, stands, and computers. As Op Center's computing needs grew, the original disarray remained where it was. There were now 4 people working in the rectangular space. Stoll and Veens now worked back-to-back in the center of the room. May Wan sat at the far end, and Jefferson sat near the door. May, who was born in Taipei, had a ring through her nose and orange hair. J2, as they called Jefferson, had no hair and a tattoo of a tree on his scalp. Veens glanced over as the trio entered the room.
Good afternoon, everyone, Hood said.
What have you got for us, Mr. Veens?
A photo ID from the files of the IODM, Veens replied. That's the International Organization of Diamond Merchants. I figured your guy must have had a job before he became a cult leader.
Good job, Stephen, Hood said.
Thank you. The computer says that the guy in the 3-year-old ID photograph and the guy in that Vatican photograph you sent over are an 89% match.
We hacked the tax records in Gaborone and got lucky right away, Stoll said.
Your man is named Thomas Burton. Until 4 months ago, he was a mine worker in Botswana.
There's the connection between Dambala and Henry Genet, Rogers observed.
I've got a small online newspaper report of the Dambala guy's first mention, J2 said. It matches the time Thomas Burton stopped making calls from his home phone.
Where did Burton live? Rogers asked.
In a town called Machaneng, May told him. They've got an industrial mine about 5 miles out of town.
You guys worked a miracle, Hood told him. I appreciate it. J2 and May each slapped the air, giving one another an across-the-room high five.
Will you be able to access any of this man's medical records? Liz Gordon asked. Yes, if they're in a computer file and that computer has an internet link, Stoll said.
Looking for anything in particular, Liz? Hood asked.
I want to try and get as much information on Dambala as possible, Liz said. If we can come up with a reliable profile, we can make some intelligent guesses as to what his next moves will be. You know, people, there's a whole voodoo angle to this thing, Stoll said. I did some research on the net. The essence of it seems to be very similar to Catholicism, actually, except that the spiritual figures dwell in the earth instead of in heaven. Vodunists and Catholics believe in an afterlife, in the notion of resurrection, in the ritualistic consumption of flesh and blood, in the sanctity of the soul, and in clear-cut forces of good and evil, which they refer to as white and black magic.
It helps to explain why Catholicism took hold in non-Islamic sections of Africa back in the 17th century, Rogers said. In the absence of a national Vodun church, Africans would have found the structure of the Catholic Church familiar and comforting.
So now Dambala wants his people back, Hood said.
That could well be the limit of Dambala's ambition, Rogers said. The larger question is what Baudin wants.
Hood nodded. He looked at Matt and his team.
Thanks, guys. You did a great job. Liz, I'd like you to stay here and see if there's any other data you can pick up on Dambala. His family background, friends, people he may have gone to school with or stood next to on the Diamond Line, that sort of thing. Work up a profile.
Sounds good, she said eagerly.
Hood left with Rogers. The men made their way back to Hood's office. Profiling Dambala is not going to give us the key to defusing this crisis, Rogers pointed out.
No, Hood agreed.
Then we'll definitely have Aideen Marley and David Batat airborne as soon as possible. They can be in Maun by tomorrow evening about 6 p.m. local time.
Good, Hood said.
Assuming we can find Dambala and get our people close, what do we do about Father Bradbury? I don't think we can do anything right now except try to get close to Dambala, Rogers said.
Then it's strictly intel gathering. No rescue attempt?
Except for Maria. None of the three has had much experience with kidnap situations, Rogers said.
They reached Hood's office and stopped.
Mike, we're going to need to get Maria on site, aren't we?
Rogers nodded.
If nothing else, Maria speaks Spanish. If she manages to hook up with the UED, she'll be able to converse with them. That could give us access to information we won't necessarily get through Edgar Klein.
I wonder if I can sell that to Daryl, Hood said, glancing behind himself to make sure the FBI liaison was not listening.
You mean the idea that his wife is going in as a glorified translator instead of as a spy? Rogers said.
Yeah.
I don't think he'll believe that, Rogers told him.
I don't think so either, Hood said.
Okay, Mike. You get Aideen and Batat going. I'll go and talk to Daryl.
Rogers turned and left. Paul Hood went into his office. He sat, heavily, behind his desk. Maun, Botswana. Friday, 8 a.m. Shortly after 8 a.m., the center's director, Swana Ndebele, went to the deacon's residential quarters. Donald Pavant opened the door. He stepped through the doorway onto the veranda. The creases of Ndebele's sunbaked skin deepened with surprise.
Who are you?
Deacon Tobias Comden of the Cathedral of All Saints, he replied.
And you are?
Swana Ndebele, the director of the center here, Ndebele replied.
He was guarded, suspicious.
I am happy to make your acquaintance, Pavant said pleasantly.
He bowed slightly. He did not want to offer his hand. His skin was rough and calloused. They were not the hands of a missionary.
and Debele pulled on his curly white beard.
The Cathedral of All Saints, he said.
I am not familiar with that church.
It is a very small church in Zambia, Pavant replied.
We came in during the night.
We?
And Debele asked.
Deacon Withall and myself, Pavant said.
The soldier stepped aside so the tour director could see into the room. Saranga was curled on the bed. His back was facing the door. Tucked in the waistband of his vestments was a Walther PPK with a silencer. It was there in the event that Swana and Debele came over to the bed for a chat and recognized him from the abduction.
How did you gentlemen get here, Deacon? And Debele asked.
We came by jeep, Pavant informed him.
Deacon Withall did most of the driving. That's why he's still sleeping. We got in very late.
I did not see a jeep, and Debele said. His mouth twisted suspiciously at one end.
Deacon Jones and Deacon Cannon took it shortly after we arrived, Pavant replied.
And Debele reacted with open surprise. Saranga felt his heart speeding up. He hoped that he would have a clear shot at the tour director. The last thing they wanted was for him to go away unconvinced.
It was felt that two sets of deacons should go to meet the bishop. The kidnappers might still be watching. We will take the tour bus.
After a long moment, and Debele nodded.
Well, that is probably a good idea, he said.
Saranga relaxed. There was conviction in the tour director's voice.
Forgive all of the questions, and Debele went on. We have all been as anxious as zebras since Father Bradbury was taken away.
I understand completely, Pavant replied. The director left, and Pavant shut the door. Saranga turned around. The Brush Viper commander sat on the edge of the bed. Pavant walked toward him. His easy manner and benevolent expression both vanished.
I'm proud of you, Saranga said. You handled that situation like a true diplomat.
How would you know? Pavant asked.
I did not have to shoot him, Saranga replied.
He removed the gun from his waistband and put it on the bed. Pavant shook his head.
I hate words. They do not solve things. They only put action off. All those gentle words about deacons, priests, and the bishop, I made myself sick. We should bring this place down, to finish the threat completely.
Why spend energy to pull down what will fall on its own? Saranga asked his partner.
Because these need to play a role, Pavant said, shaking his fists. They have been idle, while outsiders cut the heart from our people, our nation. My hands need to be active.
Maun, Botswana, Friday, 8:21 a.m. The bus to Maun would be arriving in a little over a half hour. Saranga and Pavant found peanut butter and bread in the pantry. They made two sandwiches each to eat on the veranda. They also made four more sandwiches to take with them. Once they met up with trucker No Finn and left with the bishop, they would not be able to stop for food. As the men were finishing their sandwiches, two young men walked over to the veranda. They were dressed in wide khaki shorts, short-sleeved shirts, sunglasses, and Nikes. They wore big, white Australian Outback shade hats. They looked like any members of a photo safari. One man stood a little over 6 feet tall. The other was a much broader 5'7" or 5'8". They both had extremely swarthy skin and ramrod straight posture. They stopped just short of the veranda. The taller man removed his hat and took a step forward.
Buenos dias, diáconos. He said in a strong voice.
Saranga smiled pleasantly at the speaker.
I'm sorry, my friend, the Brush Viper said, but do you happen to speak English?
The shorter man stepped forward and removed his own hat.
I speak English, he replied in a gentler voice. May we speak with you both for a moment, honored deacons?
For a moment, yes, Saranga told him. We have to prepare for our trip to Maun.
That is what we wish to talk to you about, the man told him.
The small of Saranga's back began to tingle.
I am Sergeant Vicente Diamante, and this is Captain Antonio Abreu, the man went on.
Captain Abreu bowed slightly at the mention of his name.
You are vacationing soldiers? Saranga asked.
Not vacationing, sir, Diamante replied.
We and our comrades are special forces soldiers with the Grupo del Cuartel General, UED, out of Madrid.
Pavant sneaked a glance at Soronga. Soronga did not have to look back to know what was in his eyes.
Special forces soldiers, Soronga said. Are you expecting a military assault?
We do not know, Diamante admitted. Our unit has been sent to safeguard the bishop who is coming from America.
What we want to tell you is that we consider the tour bus to be a potential target.
But don't worry. We will be armed and watching for any unusual activity.
Armed? Soronga said with a shudder.
We put our trust in the Lord.
In what do you put your trust? Machine guns? Knives?
The sergeant lightly patted a bulge under his left arm.
Our M-82s will help the Lord to protect you.
That is gratifying. How many of you are there? Soronga asked.
12, Diamante replied. We've arranged with Signor Ndebele to borrow one of the safari cars. 4 soldiers will follow the bus in that. The other 4 will remain here to make sure this area stays secure.
Soronga lowered his head gratefully.
Although I hope these precautions will not prove to be necessary, Sergeant Diamante, they are appreciated.
The 2 men left. When they had disappeared around the corner of the church, Pavant got out of his wicker chair.
None of these bloody devils understands, Pavant said angrily.
I know, Soronga answered calmly.
Part of his mind was here, dealing with Pavant's rage. The rest of it was looking ahead 3 hours, trying to figure out what to do.